CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. Hotel Mars, episode N. My colleague and co-host and co-pilot, David Livingston, Dr. Space of The Space Show. And we're thrilled to welcome Professor Jay Farahi. Jay is at the University College London, where he is professor of astrophysics, Department of Physics and Astronomy, Faculty of Mass and Physical Sciences. However, for this conversation, we're going far away to other worlds, in fact, to other exoplanets. And we're going to imagine something that I didn't know was possible. What happens after the star that has given you warmth for billions of years dies? What happens to the planets? I assumed they would disappear, but Jay, a very good evening to you. Thank you for this. The planets not only disappear, it's possible that they have an extended life. First of all, where is it that you were looking to find WD1054-226? Not a romantic name, but that is what I'm reading from the monthly notices of the Royal Astronomical Society. Were you looking for this, Jay? Good evening to you.
Thank you very much. Not exactly. We were looking for evidence of planetary systems around white dwarf stars, which when I started my career, I think people thought was quite a ridiculous idea. And I think that persists a little bit now. But I will say this, we were not looking for things in the habitable zone at all. That idea had not crossed my mind. And just to say a little story, when one of my colleagues wrote to me after I told them how long the orbit was, and he said, this is in the Goldilocks zone. I kind of said some four-letter words to him, thinking he was having a go at me or kind of pulling my leg. But so, no, we weren't looking for it. It's kind of, they say in poker, it's better to be lucky than good. So
an international team of researchers all being surprised together. Please explain, Jay, why you weren't looking for it. What is impossible about this? But there it is.
Well, to answer the question quickly, what we suspected was there was right on top of the star, kind of like Saturn and its rings, very, you know, compact, just right around in this kind of Saturn ring-like structure. And one other example had been found that was consistent with that. So when this one was found, well, much further out, much cooler, much more, say, you know, sitting on the beach temperatures, that is what we were not expecting at all. This is, you know, many, many, many times further away in an area that I would have considered cleared out by what a star like our sun would have done beforehand.
David?
Jay, excuse me, if the star is on its way out as a white dwarf, is the planetary system or the planet in the habitable zone healthy and vibrant or on its way out too?
That's exactly right, the latter part. It's on its way out too. So if you think of our sun, we've got a few billion years more yet of potentially balmy temperatures, although that won't be true everywhere on the planet and, you know, global warming. But the sun will get a little bit brighter, so that we would start to get hotter and hotter. But if our air conditioners were really good, we'd be okay until it reached the giant phase. And then we'd be out of business there without some very big, big, big engineering on planetary system scale. So the planets would then be dust. At that point, they would be swallowed up and completely engulfed by the star, kind of returning home to mother, so to speak. So we only expect things like Jupiter or Saturn could survive, not the Earth. Up to about Mars, roughly, you might be directly engulfed. But the outer planets, where we life may be possible in some of Jupiter's moons, those could potentially survive. But they would then be very cold because they would survive those bright giant phases of the sun. But then when the white dwarf emerged, it's then very dim and dimmer and dimmer and dimmer. So what we found is very close to the star where we thought it would have been engulfed by the giant. But now, whereas things like Jupiter and Saturn would be very cold, this thing is much closer to the star. And so it's warm and balmy there.
And then how did it survive? And how does it stay in a regular orbit?
That we don't know. It's an excellent question. There's two possibilities, really. One is that it existed as a full-fledged planet further out, awaiting a cold, long winter of death, you know. But there were some dynamical interactions with another planet which brought it further in, and it was captured into a shorter orbit. And you need some things to happen there. But if that's possible, then it could have been kind of cold and dead, and now it's rejuvenated, kind of a zombie planet, or we're coming up on Easter. You could think about it as a resurrected planet. The other second possibility is that it was not a planet, and there was a ring or disk of rubble made during these giant phases. Something maybe destroyed, and then that reassembled itself into a planet. That would be like a recycled planet. Those are the only two possibilities I know about. Both of them are really hard to imagine and not what we were looking for.
David?
Do you think that because this is in the habitable zone, that you could find any kind of traces of what might lead to life or some kind of advanced anything if we could see what's in the atmosphere?
It's really challenging. So right now, the planet is made on an inference of these very regular structures that we see transiting the star, which can't happen without gravitational influence of basically a planet or maybe more than one. And so that inference is basically a physical model. So right now, to verify this planet, we need more data to compare to the model, but we haven't directly observed it. And that may or may not ever happen, unfortunately, because it's so small. The current technology just can't quite get down to that. So we might get lucky. It might pass right in front of the star. But even then, seeing something like the Earth itself and what's in its atmosphere is beyond current sensitivities.
I learned from your reporting that 95% of all stars will become white dwarfs. In other words, we're in the neighborhood of a lot of common knowledge. And that
they're that's a good point. They're not actually exotic, although they sound exotic. Their properties seem exotic compared to our experience on planet Earth, but it could be up to 98% of stars. And for example, look at our sun, this bright yellow person in the sky, so to speak. That is, there's about 20 of them within 10 parsecs. There's more white dwarfs. So they're actually very abundant, but they're dim, so we don't see them in the sky.
The second part of my amateur logic is then there's a lot of pickings to go looking for other planets like this.
That's exactly what I was thinking. Yes. Yeah. And well said.
Therefore, I give you an unlimited budget, Professor. We have this. We have a fun part.
Don't tease me.
An unlimited budget. What do you want to look for first? I understand you can't see them directly, but how would any of the satellite telescopes help you, or the stuff that's in Chile? Is that helpful?
Yeah. Well, if you gave me unlimited funding, I would. So I have this very exquisite data for this star, which is a dedicated telescope instrument combination to do. So what I would do is I would target as many as I could in a very analogous fashion overnight. So we know of about 250,000 white dwarfs, and probably we could get good data for a good fraction of them. So I would try to turn one into many hundreds by looking at hundreds of thousands of systems, if I could. But that's a bit of a fantasy, but it's fun to think about these things.
David?
What's next for your research, since practically you probably don't have an unlimited budget?
Yeah, back to reality. Well, it's funny that we got this a little bit late because I was on vacation, but it's kind of cool that we did, because I'm actually applying for telescope time to monitor this system, to reobserve it, to basically watch for changes, to measure those changes, and what those changes might tell us about this planet, what its influence is, what's actually happening in more detail, in the best detail that we can get. So that's my first plan of action, is to learn more about this thing so we can get more facts about its planet and what it might be like and how it got there, etc.
In other words, you're looking for the mechanics of how planets might move.
Well, how the influence of this planet is changing this system. Because, I mean, I can tell you, these things that we're looking at, these complex transits, they are changing. They're changing almost, not quite every night, but just like a comet in our solar system would, in fact, be similar, but it changes over days and weeks as you watch the comet. There are some good analogies with that.
Professor, astrophysics, there's a surprise every day.
Well, you know, astronomers are lucky in two ways. Really, I have to say, I love astronomy history, and I will resist chasing that rabbit. But the truth is, the role of serendipity in some of the biggest ideas, of course, given how big the universe is, it's hard to get bigger than the astronomy. But so much has been serendipity and surprise and luck. And the other thing is, people like you seem to love it. So we do get a lot of good press, so to speak.
Hotel Mars, episode end with David Livingston and Professor Jay Farahy. He is at the University College London, Professor of Astrophysics, Department of Physics and Astronomy, in search of what shouldn't be there, planets around dead stars. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.